This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Ruth Todd and Maureen Rat. And with Christmas approaching, Ruth, people are thinking about what to buy for other people.
And so many books out there and so many amazing writers, poets and non-fiction.
Yes, can we just make a plea that people go and look at the New Zealand writers?
Exactly.
Because we do need to support the wonderful talent that we've got in New Zealand. It's easy to buy the best and brightest from overseas. But
they're not as bright and best as,
no,
as our own writers.
Indeed.
Book.
Yeah. So this week I've been talking with Geoffrey Paparoa-Holman, who's a Christchurch-based poet, historian, academic, and now memoirist.
And I'm thinking of the holiday season and talking to Michael Cooper with his, I think it's his 27th New Zealand Wine Guide.
Now when it rains, I hear my life in flood. The purr of gas burns blue from anthracite. Now when it rains, how near is my ferry? The light from the hall playing 45s. Now when it rains, I know I was there. There rang a bell for an epoch tolling. Now when it rains, I think of the women, mothers who bred seven sons for the pit. Now when it rains, I'm ripe to surrender, given to all that was always to be. When it rains now, we're what's left of Blackball. All that the mine was is somebody's dream, fading away at the mouth of a tunnel, where light's absolution and fresh air is sweet.
Geoffrey Paparoa-Holman, poet, historian, academic and memoirist, reading from this new work, Now When It Rains, subtitled, A Writer's Memoir. This has been a long time coming, probably, Geoffrey.
Yeah, I guess it has. When Roger Steele, my wonderful publisher, was publishing my poetry back in the 2000s, you know, he said to me, Paparoa, he said, you really should write a memoir. He said, there's so much of your life, you know, in these poems. And I heard that and thought, yeah, that's an idea sometime. And then around 2010, after I'd finished that history book I did on Alison Best, I wrote that book about my father and his war, The Lost Pilot and the Kamikaze. And so there's an element of memoir in that, but it's particularly about my relationship with him as a lead into his life and how, you know, the war affected those men, women of that generation. They were all PTSD, basically, one way or the other. If they were civilians in Britain, they got bombed. If they were on active service, they came back with what they used to call it combat fatigue, but we know now that it was, you know, particularly damaging. So this came about when I'd finished that book, and I was kind of looking around for another project, and Jeanette had been saying to me now and then, you know, how many jobs have you had? And one night we counted them and it was about 40. Not for a long time necessarily. Some of them were quite brief, others not. But, you know, it gave me a sort of repertoire in which to call upon. So I started writing the first chapter and gave it to her. And she's, you know, she's an academic. She's a professor of Māori studies and a linguist. And she doesn't tolerate bad writing or boring writing. And she said, and I'm blowing her trumpet, she said, this is really good, Geoffrey, you've got to keep writing. So that's what happened. I just wrote a chapter and gave it to her, and she pulled out the pencil for any hickeys. It might have been literals, or I'd repeated myself, something like that. But basically she felt that the writing had a good register, you know. So then I basically set out a bit of a strategy where I divided the book into three periods, and then basically set out chapter headings, which I thought, you know, I could write about a short chapter on each period. And I enlarged that a little later on because some, you know, some periods I reckoned I needed another chapter here and there. But basically I wrote to a kind of structure which sounds pre-planned and pre-programmed, but it wasn't at all. I mean, to me, writing poetry, whether it's prose or memoir, history, you know, you have to begin with a sentence. And so you have to have something that you want to say, so you have to find an interesting way of saying it. You know, there's the chapter where we leave Auckland and fly down to Christchurch on the DC-3, which probably began my session or my interest in aeroplanes and flight. And it's called Brindua Boy. We lived in Brindua in a state house, not far from where John Key actually was to live one day, strangely enough, although our destinies diverged. The Americans were operating out of the Harewood, Operation Deep Freeze. And I would look up in the sky and I would see these great planes flying over and the big Globemasters, they would fly down the Antarctic. I mean, just like they do today in the season, but these were older piston engine transports. But they were huge planes. And so we would get on our bikes and bike out to the airport. So the first sentence in that chapter is just Globemasters, right? Because it's such a powerful word. You put globe and masters together.
Yeah.
And you can see the American imperialism, you know, lodged into the name of that plane, quite unconscious, I'm sure. So, you know, that's the sentence. That's the key to the first paragraph. So that was the fun of writing it. I actually enjoyed writing it.
I was going to ask you, you get the sense that it would be an enjoyable process, but are there times, well, there must be, when trauma comes into your life and there's pain and disappointment and lost times, are they hard to revisit?
Well, I'm pretty familiar, you know, we create our own narrative, and so I'm pretty familiar with those times, and the more difficult ones, I mean, in some ways you remember the losses, the deaths, you know, the fights, the wounds, more clearly than you do, you know, a stream of continual contentment.
Happy times,
right?
Yes, indeed.
It's literature, isn't it?
Yes.
But it's also human nature. So, in a couple of places I had to grit my teeth, particularly when my partner Lee died in that road accident. But it had been nearly 40 years, so I had...
Yeah, and you've written poems and come to terms with it in lots of other ways too, haven't you?
Mm. Well, you know, people say...
not that you ever come to terms with a death like that.
Yeah, you know, they talk about getting over it and this sort of thing. And, you know, I drive over to the West Coast quite frequently. My brother lives there and I have friends who live there. And tomorrow I'm going to Blackpool. Blackpool Hilton's going to be the site of another book launch, Jane Wells and Pat Kennedy are launching a Blackpool book, just, you know, pieces about Blackpool by various people. And I've got a poem in there about the local cop back in the day. So I'm going over to attend that launch. And every time I drive through Arthur's Pass and down to Otira, I have to pass Aikens, right, which is where Lee went off the road and died. And so at that time, I always think of her and I pray, you know. And I can't pass that place without having to revisit my feelings. But obviously it's not like it was the first day it happened. And everybody is carrying something like that.
Of course we are. Absolutely.
And so when I address it in the book, I'm also addressing that fact for other people. And my whole philosophy now or theory of writing is that you tell stories to release stories in the hearer, right, or the reader. And it just happens. I get people who've read other books, but particularly this one, I'm getting responses. And they tell me what happened to them, you know, and I think, yes, you know.
It's done its job.
Well, I mean, obviously you want them to be interested in what you have to say, but unless you've made those sentences in an interesting way, in which respect, you know, 40, 50 years of writing poetry comes in, you test the sentence to vary the structure, you know, all that kind of thing, which you're doing in a poem, really, as well. You know, I think writing poetry is good for prose writers. I just wish more would do it, because you learn to be harder on yourself.
Well, every word's got to count, hasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you can't.
You can't just lose a few here and there.
Yeah, and of course, the poetry stays with you. Like, I was reading a poem of John Donne's yesterday, which came back to me. For some reason, a friend I know in England, an old friend, is probably dying, you know. And Donne wrote about dying. And he talked about his death as if he was passing through the Straits of Gibraltar. And there's a line which goes, per fretum fibris, by these straits to die. And that straits is a play on the straits being in dire straits, you know. And so that came back to me while I was thinking of Tony. So I went back and read the poem, you know. And you just see the beauty and the economy and the power of a great English poet. And those people actually, they shape your conception of what good writing is. So what I tried to do in this book, and, you know, and it's up to everybody else to judge, is to write in a way that approached poetry as far as I could while maintaining a prose narrative. It's about time, rhythm, variations as much as content. So the reader's not conscious of this, hopefully, but they're being served something which is, you know, like a variety in every page.
Well, they're conscious of it if it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's where you get the clangers.
So, Geoffrey, is there a poem you'd like to read to finish?
But maybe I'll read a West Coast poem, which
Good.
I know that Roger likes, and it's about it's actually about passing through that mountain pass and going back to the West Coast at a time when I was falling in love. It's called Papa Tipu Kissing Me, and Papa Tipu is the your homeland, you know, your Tūranga Wawe. Papa Tipu Kissing Me. Ancient rivers wake me with whispering. They know I'm home. They call you too. Invisible, you move beside me, sleep in my heart like the lie of the land. I can feel my rhythms return from beyond. We rumble through the mountain paths. Again the suction of being born. Again the chorus of buried bones, the liturgy graven by the weight of the stone. I've dreamt like a pope of kissing this land. Papa Tipu, Papa Tipu. Now I bend to so kiss you, te kuku o te manawa, the pincers of the heart, te kuku o te manawa, the pincers of the heart.
Thank you, Geoffrey. The book is called Now When It Rains, A Writer's Memoir by Geoffrey Paparoa-Holman and published by Steele Roberts.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.
Michael Cooper, New Zealand's most acclaimed wine writer, has his new buyer's guide out for its 27th edition. Always look forward to it, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ruth. Ruth, good to be with you.
Now, I always go to the page with the best value wines and quality this summer. And tell me about the best buyer's guides on, well, the best buyer's guides on the planet, somebody wrote about you.
Oh, that was a very nice comment by Leighton Smith.
Oh, that's right.
Who, of course, has been a wine producer, but he's more recently sold his country house and the associated vineyard.
So, well, first perhaps we should start with that 5 million glasses of New Zealand wine are drunk every day around the world. But it's also, you said in an article in The Listener, I think, recently, that we're drinking fewer glasses in New Zealand.
We are indeed. Our consumption of wine over the last decade has declined by about 10%, and our consumption of New Zealand wine has declined even more, declined by 20%. So imported wines, which have about 35 to 40% of the wine we drink, is from overseas. And that's particularly in this under $10 category, where New Zealand can't compete with, for example, cheap Australian reds. You know, our weather's just not suitable for making, you know, low-priced red wine. Fortunately, of course, we make high-quality wine, and we're able to export it. But for wineries, if they're not exporting, there is this problem of this declining, not just wine consumption in New Zealand, but alcohol consumption. It's affecting the beer industry, it's affecting the spirit industry. There's only two growth areas. One is, believe it or not, gin, and the other one is craft beers, which are doing really well.
Why do you think that's happening? I mean, is it to purely cost that people can't afford New Zealand wines now so much?
Well, of course, given the fact that it's across the board in terms of alcoholic beverages, I think it's more deep-rooted than cost. I think it's partly a maturing of New Zealand society where there are fewer people around who are drinking large amounts at any one time. That, I think, is partly reflecting the drink and drive laws where people now know that if they, you know, drink several glasses, then they're at risk if they're driving. But also what I notice is with young people, And my two daughters are both in their 20s, and I meet a lot of their friends, and a lot of them are extremely moderate when it comes to their wine consumption. And for example, if they join us for dinner, they'll have a glass, but if you say to them, would you like another, they say, no, I'm fine, I've, you know, I've had a glass.
So that's a good thing?
I think it's an excellent thing, because I think, you know, it parallels what it's like with food, don't you think, that people are becoming more careful what they put in their body. They want to know where it comes from. They want to know if it's healthy. And so I think that's all great for New Zealand society, but it does present a challenge for wine growers.
So more and more will go overseas, I guess.
Which is good, and there is scope for growth for New Zealand, but the problem there is that the average price at which we're selling our wine overseas has dropped by 25% in the last decade. And so exports are more and more being dominated by big companies, which are often themselves overseas owned. And if you're a small winery, so imagine if you're, you know, up in Waipa or down in Central Otago, it's very expensive and demanding and exhausting to be, you know, traipsing around the world selling your wine. So one good thing is that with the boom in tourism, there are more and more overseas, tourists visiting wineries. And so for those producers who have, for example, a restaurant or a popular cellar door, if you can sell more of your wine directly there to the public, then that's a good thing.
Indeed.
And that's happening on Waiheke Island now. You know, most producers will tell me that they aim to sell most of what they produce at their cellar door to, you know, well-heeled, you know, tourists from overseas who'll come and have an expensive lunch and drink, you know, a few bottles of wine. And but not every winery is lucky enough to have that, outlet.
Interesting to see how things go. So Thornbury Marlborough Sauvignon was your pick for 2018.
Well, I first tasted that wine several months ago and, tasting it blind, and I thought, oh, well, this is a very good example of the 2018 Marlborough Sauvignon Blancs. You know, it's got everything you're looking for in terms of its crisp and lively and aromatic and punchy flavours and so on. And so I gave it 4 stars, which is equal to a silver medal, and I assumed that it would be, you know, selling for about $20. And then I saw that the recommended retail price was only $14.50. And I really thought...
Yes, I've bought it for that price, and it's amazing.
Well, thank you, and I'm pleased that you, enjoyed it. And some retailers have been offering it, you know, down around $12.95.
Goodness
so
me.
So for me, that 4-star wine at about a 2.5-star price.
And what about the Esk Valley Best Red?
Well, I think that's the sort of wine that I'm a great lover of Bordeaux-style reds, which, you know, 20 years ago in Hawke's Bay, they were super popular. But, of course, Pinot Noir is now dominant, you know, right around the South Island and up into Martinborough. The red wines of Hawke's Bay are, I suppose, less fashionable than what they used to be. The good news for listeners, though, and for wine lovers, is that puts downward pressure on price. So Merlot being the main red wine variety in Hawke's Bay, and they tend to blend it often with varieties like Cabernet Sauvignon. And then you get producers like Esk Valley that have been around forever and where the winemaker Gordon Russell's hugely experienced. In fact, I saw him in Queenstown last week, which was just a pure coincidence. So a wine like that really is as good as many $30 reds. And yet we can buy it for, at the most, $19.95, and it goes on special down to about $16.
I must look out for that one because I like my reds, especially in the winter. You've also got in the listener, this latest listener, you've got rosés and sparkling wine, champagne wines, and what's your pick for those for Christmas?
Well, of course, rosé is the hot new wine style, and it's been wonderful to see this happen in recent years. I suppose two I'll mention, you know, off the top of my head, Ruth. I do a list of classic wines of New Zealand in my buyer's guide, and I've just bought through the first rosé that I've added to my list of classic wines. In other words, they have to be really good year in, year out.
Yes.
and that is Terra Sancta Bannockburn Central Otago Rosé, which in my view has been really achieving at the very top end now for 6 or 7 years with rosé. So for listeners who want to taste one of the country's greatest rosés, I recommend the Terra Sancta from 2018. Another one to mention, though, that I stumbled across that I think is great value. I was at a tasting of at Pernod Ricard, which owns all sorts of brands, including Brancott Estate, and one of their marketing person told me that her go-to wine at home was Montana Reserve Rosé. And when I went to the tasting, I could see why she rated it so highly, because number one, it's like 4-star quality. Number two, you can buy it for about $15, so it's great value. So for an all-purpose, highly affordable rosé, I suggest the Montana Reserve, and for a more special wine at a higher price, the Terra Sancta Rosé.
Great. So people who are looking for good wines at good prices over the holidays, get hold of Michael Cooper's New Zealand Wines 2019. Michael, just before we go, what about this wine from Bannockburn that's won the a world title? That doesn't happen very often, does it?
Well, I think that it's certainly always great for a producer when you win a trophy like that overseas, because it obviously draws attention to the wine and helps to sell the wine not only into retailers but out, you know, to wine lovers. I think it must always be borne in mind that basically the world's top producers tend not to enter competition.
Right.
Because you've got really very little to gain and a lot to lose, in the sense that you imagine if you're a top Pinot Noir producer and you're getting, I don't know, $100 a bottle for your wine, as most of the top French producers do. If they get a gold medal, all that's doing is really just sort of telling us what we already know.
Yes.
But if they get a silver medal, they're actually sort of undermining their ability to command high prices.
Oh, right.
So the competitions tend to attract more younger producers who are trying to get established, trying to make their name. And in this case, it certainly is quite a formidable achievement to win that trophy 2 years in a row.
Yes, for New Zealand. It's a little bit more expensive, of course, but it's good because it again helps put Pinot Noir out there, doesn't it, from Central?
Oh, yeah. Yes, in fact, you know, the industry at the moment is worried that we've got too many eggs in one basket. You know, more than a half of all New Zealand wine is one variety from one region. In other words, Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc accounts for more than a half of all New Zealand wine. Fortunately, we've got a backup option, you know, internationally now, where people around the world increasingly accept that our Pinot Noirs are often outstanding and often really good value. And so we need that sort of, you know, now we've got a famous white and a famous red, so that's good for the industry.
Yes. Well, Michael, enjoy whichever wines you choose for Christmas dinner and the holidays, and thank you for bringing us up to date with New Zealand Wines 2019, Michael Cooper's Buyer's Guide. 3,000 New Zealand wines tasted and rated. I don't know how you do it, but it must be fun.
it's the best job on the planet.
And New Zealand Wines 2019 is published by Upstart Press.
And join us, Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd, next Tuesday on Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.